So welcome everyone. It's a great pleasure to have Professor Sean Han from University of Glasgow to give the Strong Gravity seminar today. Professor Han is an expert on the data analysis side of gravity wave detection. His main research focuses on search for short bursts of gravity waves with unmodeled waveforms. He's a member of the first analysis group in the LIGO scientific collaboration. Today, he's going to talk about enhancing transient gravitational wave analysis with machine learning. Sean, please take it away.
Thank you very much, Juan. Can I just check that you can see my mouse? Because I'm going to use it as a pointer. Okay, great. Thank you. Yeah, so welcome, everyone. Thank you very much for coming to this seminar. As I was telling Juan earlier, that this is my first seminar via this Zoom platform. I've given talks in a more formal setting. Seminars, I guess, should be a bit more relaxed. So it's a new thing for me. Today, I'm going to be talking about using machine learning, as Juan said, for gravitational wave analyses, transient gravitational wave analyses. It's something I have collaborated with Chris Messenger on. But I have to say that Chris is very much the lead person and the brains behind a lot of this work. So he's given me lots of input and we've discussed this kind of work a lot before. The other thing I should mention is that the people who are doing all the hard work, the grunt work, the researchers and the PhD students, Jordan McGinn and Hunter Gabbard, and we will discuss their work later on. So, okay. So this is the overview. We'll talk with a very brief introduction of gravitational waves and so on and so forth. Then just so everybody's on the same page, we'll talk about neural networks and in a particular kind of neural network setup called autoencoders. And then we talk about a particular kind of autoencoder called these convolutional variational autoencoders for rapid parameter estimation. And then we talk about another kind of neural network, or rather two neural networks put together, called these generative adversarial networks, and to generate these burst waveforms. So burst in this context, and I'll mention a bit later as well, is these generic transients of unmodeled or poorly modeled gravitational wave signals from sources like supernovae and so on and so forth. And then I'll end with a summary. Okay, so maybe not everyone's familiar with the group at Glasgow. So this is the Institute of Gravitational Research. I'm just one of 13 academics at the Glasgow group. We have two recent additions, which is kind of weird because I've not actually met these people in person since they officially started at the group. They are Christopher Berry and Eric Oakley. But that's the nature of this pandemic. But nonetheless, this is the whole team, and the director of the Institute of Gravitational Research is Professor Shiro Rohn. And so that's Chris for anybody who wondering what he looks like. Okay, perhaps for those not familiar with gravitational waves, when I talk about transient gravitational waves, I'm talking about things in this top row. Okay, let me just take a step back. For logistical and maybe historical reasons, gravitational wave analyses are split into these sort of four categories. So this four boxes here represent each category of analyses in the gravitational wave community. So they are coalescent CBC, compact binary coalescences. Okay, and there are these burst sources, as I mentioned before, and then there are continuous wave sources. So these would be emitted from rapidly rotating neutron stars, isolated, with little humps on them or little asymmetries, and then the stochastic background, stochastic gravitational wave background, rather. And this would be akin to the cosmic microwave background, except that the ones that are potentially detectable by ground-based detectors like LIGO and Virgo would be from a sort of a foreground of a population of binary coalescences of binary black holes or binary neutron star coalescences. Okay, and this is sort of also a bit of a matrix. So on this column here, there's this label modeled, and so these sources here of these binary coalescences and the and these neutron star rapidly rotating neutron stars, they are considered well modeled, where the waveform is relatively well known. And on this side, this column here, this is unmodeled, and so these this situation where the waveform is unknown or very difficult to model, as you can imagine, for stochastic background, it's not really a waveform as such. And for core collapse supernova, you know, a lot of people spend a lot of computing time trying to compute this the waveform from these things, and so they're difficult to model, and they've got lots of microphysics to work in. And then on this row, there's the short and the long in the terms of the duration of the signal. So the transient signals I mentioned cover both these categories here on the top row, okay? Right, So what are gravitational waves? Maybe I should have mentioned that before I talked about sources of gravitational waves, but gravitational waves are ripples in space-time, and they travel at the speed of light. This is the one sentence description of gravitational waves. They are emitted, they're radiated. It occurs when there's mass moving very, very rapidly. Well, the ones that we can detect require very rapid motions of very large masses, such as black holes going around each other just before they collide. And so, and those are the kinds of signals that we have observed here in this bottom right corner. And this is the rather famous first detection of gravitational waves of the binary black holes. And this is the signal at the Hanford detector and the signal at the Livingston detector. For the methodologies I will describe, I will mainly describe, you know, detecting compact binary coalescences, detecting poorly modeled signals. The process is there, but it's a bit more difficult to describe. So I will just leave it for today. But nonetheless, also the machine learning problems that I want to discuss, perhaps maybe more relevant in at least for the first half of the talk to compact binary coalescences. Okay. So here's my one slide primer for gravitational wave detection. There's a lot more work than just this one slide, but I'm trying to just give you a very brief overview of the process. If we have data from the detector, which is called H of T, and this is a strain output from the detector, let's say, and inside this here, there is some signal, a simulated signal, okay, that's been embedded in this time series. To extract this signal from this time series, we would have a template, a signal template, a model of the signal, okay? And here we have this in spiral, and you can see its frequency is increasing as the two masses, as a model of two masses get closer and closer together, and also the amplitude is increasing. And we take this is the model of our signal, so our signal template, and we convolve it with the data, okay? So this is meant to be a convolution signal, symbol, excuse me. And so in the process of convolving the signal template with the time series data, we're basically taking this template and just running it along in time, because that's what a convolution does, multiply it at all possible times. And then at the time when it matches, when the template matches the signal embedded in here, the output has a nice strong peak here, okay? And so this nice strong peak is this thing we call Z, and this is basically, this vertical line is this signal to noise ratio if we apply match filtering. Okay, so I've introduced the word match filtering. Match filtering is basically the process of taking this template and trying to match it with the data and eventually finding a peak that corresponds to the strength of the signal. And the strength of the signal is the signal to noise ratio, often depicted as rho. Okay. This Z time series actually can be rewritten as in terms of the Fourier components. So instead of having h of t, h as a function of time, s as a function of time. We take the Fourier transforms, so we get h of f and s of f, okay? And here, basically, a convolution in the time domain is a product in the frequency domain, okay? And so we have this product just with this complex conjugate there. And we need to normalize it by the noise. And so we just divide it by the noise here, okay? And so this is just a Fourier transform to get it from the Fourier domain back into the time domain to get Z of T, which is this signal to noise ratio time series. Okay. So this very simple example has one template and one signal that corresponds to the template. But you know, in principle, we don't actually know exactly the parameters. So while we have the model, we don't know exactly the parameters of the model. For example, the mass of the binary components, and so on and so forth. And so we need to get a template, create a template bank of lots of different signals. And then we ask which of these templates best match whatever is in our data. Okay, and we want to cover as much of the required parameter space as possible to minimize the loss of signal-to-noise ratio. Now, this sounds quite hefty because a template bank can be tens of thousands or 100,000 templates, but this actually can be done quite quickly and efficiently using basically highly parallelized computing. So you have a big computing cluster and you throw all the individual analyses at this computing cluster. And in some instances, it can be done in near real time, okay? So, this is, though quite computationally intensive, can be done very time efficient manner. That's one thing to bear in mind. Now, the other part of the analysis for compact binaries is the parameter estimation. So the parameter estimation is basically the analysis that tells us the astrophysical properties of the detected signals. And this is done within a Bayesian framework. And so here we have a Bayes theorem, the probability. This is the posterior, the likelihood, the prior, and the evidence. Okay, so the probability of X given Y is and some additional information is equal to the probability of Y given X, some information multiplied by your assumptions of X divided by some normalizing factor called the evidence. So in the world of a compact binary, parameter estimation, X would be your parameters that you want to infer. So X need not be one variable, but a set of variables. And Y would be the data, okay, the input data, the H of T, for example, that you saw previously. And so our likelihood is basically the probability of the data given the presence of a signal of some parameters. And then the prior is basically our assumptions of the distribution of the values of these parameters, you know. For example, we assume that the sources should be distributed isotropically across the sky, uniformly across the sky, excuse me. And so so we have a prior on right ascension and declination that reflects our assumptions, and so on and so forth, okay? So we need to calculate the likelihood and multiply it with our assumptions in the prior, and then that gives us our posterior. And so here, just taken from this particular paper for this particular detection, is an example posterior. It's probably a bit more complicated than it should be for a first introduction to what a posterior is, but let's just look at the bottom distribution, okay? So here is the mass M1, so one of the component masses in the binary. And the height of this reflects the probability that the component M1, the mass, the first component, has this particular mass. So if you like, it is most probable around 30 and not very probable around 50. Okay, and this is in units of solar masses, excuse me. And so we would typically do the parameter estimation, get the parameters, and say that parameters correspond to, let's say, 30 plus or minus 39 and, I don't know, 25 or something like that. And from there, state lists that this is our estimate of the physical parameters associated with this particular detection. Okay, this thing here is a two-dimensional posterior, okay, for the first component mass and the second component mass. And so the darkness of the shade of purple here is basically the density of the posterior. So it's very highly peaked here, and it's not very, the posterior is not very high out here where it's much paler. And so just to show you what that is. Now you may ask, why does it look like that with this line here? This line here is just because of a definition that we define, assume that M1 by convention is always more massive than M2, okay? And so once you cross this line, there's a symmetry. And so it's basically inferring that M2 and M1 have swap places, so it's no need to have the posterior there. And so that's just why it's kept limited to that region. Now, the gravitational wave signal, the model for a binary coalescence, is quite a high dimensional system, especially when you consider all the other parameters like spin and so on and so forth. And so we need to be very efficient with our likelihood calculation. So most of the computational costs of this step is in the calculation of the likelihood, and is very costly for a very high dimensional system. Which means that firstly, you can't just do what we call the brute force approach of just picking systematic values across your entire parameter space. Because then if you just want 10 samples in a 15 dimensional space, you need 10 to the power of 15 samples, which basically is, very, very untractable. So we have stochastic algorithms, quasi-stochastic algorithms like Markov chain Monte Carlos, MCMCs, and nested sampling to do a more efficient evaluation of our parameter space. Okay, these things are fast, but there's still issues. Oh, wait, and the issues I will mention in a minute. So I wanted to show you a nice animation, which unfortunately won't work here because I had to switch to the PDF version. But this is what's called the binary black hole, orrery. And these are all the binary black holes that have been detected so far from the first observing run to the first half of the third observing run. This is the first detection, 1509-14. If you go to this link at the bottom of this here, or just look up LIGO orrery, I think, or binary black hole orrery, you'll find this animation. And basically, it shows all the orbits going around each other and then merging within this amount of time from coalescence, which is I quite like this animation. Here's another diagram of all the detections so far. So there are about 38, I think, binary black hole detections and 2 binary neutron star detections confirmed, I should say. There are more to come. But yeah, this is just to show you the menagerie that we have. The vertical scale is the mass of the components and also of the final object that's created by the merger. Okay. So we've detected many things, we will detect even more because we expect the detectors, hopefully, to be even more sensitive and probe even further out, probe an even larger volume. And in the process of probing an even larger volume, therefore detect more signals, we will have more detections to analyze. And, well, the boring, the great stuff is that we have more science to do. The boring stuff, or the rather boring challenge is that, how do we deal with all the computational issues associated with these analyses? One of the big issues with gravitational wave parameter estimation is that it's slow. Okay, for a typical detection from O3, the third observing run, each parameter estimation run can take anywhere between 6 hours and 5 days just for one of these detections. Okay, there are approximations which are rapid and do full that do sort of partial estimations of the posterior, especially for sky localization, and this is to aid astronomy, follow up observations of gravitational wave detections. But there are currently no, well, at least people have been working on rapid estimations of the full Bayesian posterior, because the full Bayesian posterior can provide rapid estimates on other binary parameters, such as, for example, the mass, masses of the components, you can imagine that an astronomer will want to know whether the components are neutron stars or binary black holes, for example. Well, that's not the best example because we actually have other tools that try and tell them whether something is a binary black hole or binary neutron star. But for example, having more information rapidly will potentially allow the other people to make decisions about how they want to observe and what they want to observe. Okay. So rapid parameter estimation is important for multi-messenger astrophysics, but also for computational efficiency in the world where, we are being told to be more efficient with our computing, that there's not an infinite amount of computing that we can have access to. We should try to be more efficient with our analyses. And so the first thing I want to discuss is to use machine learning or machine learning approaches to speed up parameter estimation, okay? And so machine learning, it comes in many forms, but the most common and I guess popular form nowadays is in the form of neural networks. And I would say very quickly, I will talk about neural network basics very quickly so that everybody is on the same page. Let me check my time. Yeah, okay, I'm a little bit behind time, but let's hope we can get somewhere soon. So in a neural network, as the name suggests, we have lots of neurons. So these these purple things are meant to be neurons. These gray things are inputs, okay? And each neuron combines data from multiple inputs, okay? As you can see, this is one layer of neurons, and then you have another layer of neurons. And the next layer of neurons here in this example is taking inputs from multiple neurons in the previous layer, okay? And so it takes the inputs from previous layers, which can be just direct inputs or outputs from neurons, and then it does a combination, it does a linear combination, a weighted linear combination of these inputs. And then this weighted linear combination is fed into a function. And these functions, sigma, represented by sigma here, are what's called activation functions. And here are some examples of activation functions. Sigmoid, ReLU. ReLU stands for rectilinear unit. And then there's also leaky ReLU, okay, where you have a non-zero negative axis. As you can see, these functions are a bit like switches. If the argument of the function, let's say, is greater than zero, then it is propagated to the next neuron. For ReLU. If it's less than zero, then it's set to zero, and that output's not propagated to the next neuron. And then if it's Riki Lilu, then it has some other properties. It lets data go forwards and backwards, for example. But let's not talk about that too much. So that's why they're called activation functions. They activate, when it reaches a particular level and so on and so forth. Okay, so it allows, it weights the amount of information from one neuron to be propagated to the next neuron and so on. The other thing to note about neural networks is how the data set is broken up. So the data set is broken up into three: the training, the validation, and the testing. In the training phase, you are basically training the weights and the biases, this W. I hope you can see this W and this B. Apologies for it being a bit small. And so you want to train these weights and biases so that your output is as close to what you want. For example, if you're training a neural network to identify cats from dogs, then you want to make sure that whenever you give it a cat picture, it tells you the output classifier tells you it's a cat picture, and same for a dog. And if it's not, then you have to readjust these weights and biases. Okay, and so the training process is basically for tuning these things. And then there's this validation data set, which is used for training the hyperparameters. So the hyperparameters are other parameters that I've not mentioned here that help the network learn. Okay, so if you one example of hyperparameter is the learning rate. The neural network tries to get to the right answer typically by gradient descent or some form of gradient descent. And the steps it takes from one iteration to the next is basically the learning rate, okay? And so if your learning rate is small, then it's doing the gradient descent, but in very small steps. And so you need to iterate, you need to give it a train a lot before you get the right answer. On the other hand, if your learning rate is too large, then you may run the risk of oscillating around the optimal value, okay? And then you may not actually find, it will again take a long time to get to the correct answer to minimize the gradient and have the network working correctly. So there are these hyperparameters that also need to be tuned. And then finally, there's the testing. The testing is always just set aside to evaluate the performance of the network at some point, okay? And the idea here is to, for example, if you want to have cats and dogs example, it will tell you the percentage of the data that is correctly labeled cat or dog and so on and so forth. And during the whole training process, the whole measurement of performance is done by this loss function, okay? And the loss function measures how close the predicted values are to the truth. This is not to be confused with this performance evaluation. The loss function is, if you like, a distance measure of how close you are to the truth, okay? Whereas the performance is just telling you how much of the testing data you got right. And you want to get 100% right, okay? Right, so that's basically a quick fire summary of neural networks. And neural networks, in particular convolutional neural networks, have been shown that for a detection problem where you're classifying whether the data contains a signal or not signal, in these situations, it has the ability to have a sensitivity that matches match filtering. And so this is from this particular paper. So there are many papers on this topic. I'm being particularly parochial and just mentioning the Glasgow papers. But if you look up, machine convolution neural networks for detection, you'll find several papers on this. This is just one particular paper I'll reference here. You can see that the match filtering performance, this is on the horizontal axis is increasing signal to noise ratio. And on the vertical axis is basically the probability of detection, okay? And so the neural, and here you have the line, solid line is false alarm probability of 1, 0.1, and 0.01, and 0.001. And you can see that they sort of match. They do a bit better here, but I would take that with maybe a grain of salt. Nonetheless, the key of this paper was to show that convolutional neural networks, this kind of approach for detection, for classification of signal and non-signal, can do what match filtering is doing.
Hey, Sion, can I ask
yes.
a question?
Go ahead, Reed.
Good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you too.
Feel free to punt this. We can catch up later. But do you have an understanding of why the neural network is outperforming match filter, since match filtering should be optimal if you have linear Gaussian noise?
Oh, okay. This is, now you're opening kind of worm. So
we can talk about this, like, if you want to finish your slides.
No, that's okay. But firstly, match filtering, I'll take this thing offline, but let's answer your question first, because I would like to say that actually the Bayes factor is optimal and the match filtering is not quite optimal, but the match filtering works well for Gaussian noise. And you're right that match filtering should be doing a better job than CNNs here. I think that in this particular case, the false alarm probability is just, false alarm probability is basically 10%. So 1 in 10 would be a false alarm rate, a false alarm in this case. And in this particular situation, it looks like it's outperforming. I would suggest that then maybe, like I said, take it a grain of salt, because there might be error bars associated with these estimates. That's how I would see it. We can discuss about match filtering being optimal and so on, maybe offline somewhere else, some other time. Sorry about that.
No, thanks. Okay.
I would say, in general, most demonstrations of convolutional neural networks for filtering, for detection, have shown that they are on par with match filtering. Okay, and the key is to demonstrate it at a false alarm probability that we would consider to be a detection probability. So this work here was the demonstration of its first demonstration of its kind. And for people who do gravitational waves analysis, they would say, well, false alarm probability of 0.001 is not that great. And we would want something like, 10 to the minus 6 or something like that as well. So there are some caveats associated with this kind of work, but I think there is work around that shows that at reasonable false alarm probabilities that we would make for detections, and sometimes in real noise, although I'm getting the two pictures mixed up, these convolutional neural networks can do the job. Okay, I should move on. Now, I've just said convolutional neural networks when previously I've just been talking about neural networks. I will say very quickly that the convolutional part is mainly for data reduction, okay? And the convolutional is just combining multiple data points together to reduce the size of the data to focus in on features and so on and so forth. So a 16 by 16 image through a convolutional filter would end up being a 4 by 4 image, for example, okay? This is a neural network or convolutional neural network deployed as classifiers, just to make a decision about whether it's one kind or the other. And also, I just want to show very quickly that, again, just promoting our own stuff, that we've also showed that this approach also works for supernovae. So we inject not your nice well-behaved binary black hole in spirals, but instead supernovae waveforms, and find that we can also tune convolutional neural networks to perform well for these signals. Okay, now I want to move on to talk about these autoencoders, in particular variational autoencoders. And I need to look at the time again because I'm, Okay, so I've talked about neural networks, but an autoencoder is a sort of particular configuration of a neural network. It's basically one neural network here attached to another neural network. Okay. Now, the key is that this shape is actually informative. The autoencoder has an encoding part which takes some input data and encodes it down into a set of what we call latent variables, and which are typically less in dimensions than the input data. Okay, so this is a dimensional reduction step here. And the decoder, as the name suggests, takes this latent space, decodes it, and tries to reconstruct something that you want. And in this case, in this very basic case, you want the input and the output to look identical if possible, okay? So as close as possible. And so in a typical standard autoencoder setup, your loss function would just be the difference between the output and the input, or rather the chi-squared, if you like. And in between, there is this latent space, which has some nice properties, like it could be considered compression, compressing the image, and so on and so forth. But let's not dwell on that for now, because I need to talk about variational autoencoders. Okay, now, variational autoencoders are very similar to autoencoders, except instead of having a latent space that is a bunch of numbers, as I had previously mentioned here, now your latent space is defined by an n-dimensional Gaussian. Excuse me. Okay, and so the encoder encodes your input into a series of multiple Gaussians, which have n-dimensional means and variances. Okay, and all these means and variances come together to become one blob of n-dimensional. One blobby n-dimensional Gaussian overall. Okay. And the decoder can pick some part of this n-dimensional space. So we pick a value from this Gaussian, this n-dimensional Gaussian, put it into the decoder, and it should give us our input again. And so very similar to to the normal autoencoder, our loss function is just the input and the output, except there's an extra loss component, because the loss component says that we want to keep our latent space to be a Gaussian average over all possible inputs. Okay, so the overall latent space should be a Gaussian. That's, yeah, it can be a different shape, but the most common shape is a Gaussian. Okay. So as you can, so what does that mean? So it means that if you give it a three, image of a three, it goes to this location. If you give it an image of a six, it goes to this other location. And note, it's not a series of numbers, but it's actually a bunch of an n-dimensional Gaussian living in some part of the overall parameter space. And here, deliberately drawn, the six lives in a different part of that parameter space. Okay. And so you have probably another part of parameter space for the fives and the eights and so on and so forth. So you can have you could have it produce hand-drawn digits. Sorry, I should have said this is the rather famous MNIST hand-drawn digit data set. And you can have all these hand-drawn digits encoded into your overall latent space. Okay. And so let's look at the picture first, and I'll talk about the details in the text. So as I said before, you can have all the different digits living in different parts of the parameter space, and we want to combine all these together so that they live in some Gaussian, n-dimensional Gaussian latent space. Okay, and to have it be an n-dimensional Gaussian, we use the Kullback-Leibler divergence, the KL divergence, and that as a loss function, and that is used to keep this to be a Gaussian of zero mean and unit variance. Okay. Then, whenever we want to have generate an image, we just pick somewhere. Sorry, we pick a value from this n-dimensional Gaussian, put it into the decoder, and out spits an image of a number of a digit. Okay. Now, you can see that in this sort of setup, you don't have very much control about which digit the decoder spits out, because you make a random draw from the latent space. And so you can actually condition the inputs by adding a label and telling the encoder and the decoder the label that's associated with the image. So this label here is three, because we're giving an image of three, goes in, and so it encodes both the label and the image into some part of parameter space, and then the decoder has to come out and do the same. So the loss functions are, again, it has to be a three that looks like that, okay? And so once trained, we can have draws from the latent space conditioned on some label, like a one, and it should give us a one. And then if we just give it a three, and it gives it a three, for example, okay? That is the conditional variational autoencoder. So very many adjectives put together. The idea again is that we now have the ability to map an image or some input data into some n-dimensional Gaussian latent space. We can label that data, we can provide the data with the label, and when we give it the same label at the decoder, it should be able to draw from this n-dimensional dimensional space and give us the desired output that corresponds to this label. Okay, and this is this conditional variational autoencoder. All these diagrams were made not by me, not by Chris, but by this very nice blog about conditional variational autoencoders. So if you want to get a primer, have a look at this. It's quite nice. It goes through things step by step, probably better than what I just did. Okay. Now, let's get a bit of mathematical substance into what I just said. The encoder network and decoder network, well, the encoder network, we should think of it in terms of a probability distribution, okay? So we want to encode something that is related to the probabilities that we want. And the decoder function is a modeling function, and that function is should correspond, or it should be an approximation of the posterior probabilities that we want on the output. Okay, I'll say more about this in a minute, but just to sort of get you used to the nomenclature, So the input, the encoder, is trying to model this probability of Z, Z being the latent space, okay, latent space location, given some input data and some label, okay. And then at the output, there's some function given some label and the latent space, we should get the thing that we want, which is X. It's the image corresponding to what we want. And the loss function for conditional variational autoencoder looks typically something like this, okay? L is unfortunately used here, but because L has a different meaning later on. But this thing here, okay, is what we call the reconstruction loss. It's a bit like a chi-squared, right? It's the what we generated from the decoder minus the thing that we want, the input, the true image that we want. Okay, X is the thing that we want. And then all squared and average over everything. So this is what's called the reconstruction loss. And then this other thing here, this other component here, sorry, is the KL divergence between the latent space distribution and a Gaussian of zero mean and a unit variance, okay? And there's some weighting here, and that weighting is just technicality. I will mention that again maybe in a minute. So the loss function for CVAEs, this conditional variation autoencoders, takes this form. And we want to use this because basically we want to map our data into a probability distribution function. The goal here is to have a rapid inference method to create Bayesian posterior probabilities of the parameters. Okay, and the tool that we've developed is this thing called Vitamin. The VI is for variational inference. The Tamin is just something that's just tacked on. So Hunter gave it this name, Hunter Gabbard. So it's just Vitamin. And Vitamin right now, the things we'll see is basically trained on whitened time series, binary black hole time series, and the binary black holes added to Gaussian noise, looking like this, okay? And we also give it, in addition to the time series, the true parameter values. And with only this two information, we want it to produce the posterior distribution of the parameters, okay? And note, we do not give it the posteriors. So the posteriors probability distributions are not used in training. And this is key because the posterior probability distributions are the things that are very expensive to calculate, right? If we need to generate many, many of them and we use like a million, in fact, 10 million training samples here, to generate 10 million posterior distributions is basically impossible. So instead, we only need to generate 10 million time series, and that's very, very doable. Note the parameters associated with each of these simulated time series and use these as input to our training. So why does it work? Firstly, let me just show you the architecture of this, and in a moment you can see I'll talk about it in more detail. So let's just talk about this the architecture of this Vitamin. I'm running out of time. So Y and X previously were different things. So for Vitamin, X are the true parameters, okay? True parameter values. Y is the data, okay? And we want to know the posterior, which is P of X given Y. But the posterior is actually really difficult to compute. This is a thing that takes hours to days. And so instead, we want to actually make some approximate function that will allow us to draw samples from the posterior rapidly. Okay, so this will just generate posterior samples, this R of XY. So R of XY is our approximation of P of XY. And R of XY is a combination of, so let me just very quickly saying that the Vitamin is two encoders, one to encode the true parameter values, a combination of the true parameter values and the data. And the other one just to encode the data itself. So this side, this R here and R here, at least this R here does not see the true parameters, whereas Q does see the true parameters. Q is this thing called the recognition function. Basically, it allows us to map a truth into a latent space, okay, and allow us to then compare the mapping of the latent space of Y, which does not have the true parameters, to something that has true parameters during training. And so in principle, this latent space here should have very similar properties to the latent space that has seen the true parameters, via minimizing the KL divergence between these two latent spaces. And then it takes passes on a latent variable and then data again, and then this is the upside down triangles are the encoders, because it's going from many to little few, and the triangles, the normal oriented triangles, are the decoders. So it takes two and then expands it to the posteriors, and the posteriors then are used to calculate a loss function, and this is a reconstruction loss function to figure out whether the true parameters are within the posterior samples that we have. Okay, this is for training. For testing, we don't actually know. We shouldn't know the truth behind the data, and so we only give it the data. Okay, and here you can see that now the data maps into a latent space. That latent space is trained to be as close to the latent space of data plus truth, okay, as possible, so that it gives you a latent variable, and so Y goes to there. And if you like, pictorially, this is tries to mimic this root where it knows the true parameter values, okay, and then it gives you an output that is a sample from the for parameters that you want.
Sean, can I ask a question here?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
So how large is your latent space? So now you have, like, let's say 15 parameters.
Yeah.
Is the dimension of your latent space also 15 or?
Yes, actually, it's a 15 dimensional Gaussian latent space. Yes. Okay. Yeah. It can be more, it can be less, but in the particular version that we have right now, it's 15. So we've tried 20, for example. You can have it more. There are tricks where if you have latent spaces that are degenerate, then they can turn themselves off, and so the weight, each mean and variance has a weight associated with that. It's a bit like a Gaussian mixture model, okay. Mm-hmm. And so you can, if it's degenerate, then the weight for that particular Gaussian can turn off, go to zero if you like, and so on and so forth. So the one that we have right now is basically 15 for 15 dimensions. Actually, let's just say 15 for 15 dimensions. Okay. Instead. Yeah. Now here I did a lot of hand waving, and here I need to do a little bit more hand waving, but hopefully behind some mathematics. This thing works, and this thing works because we are minimizing the cross entropy. Okay. The cross entropy is the entropy is basically, so the entropy typically, right, is P log P. In information theory, it's typically P of X log P of X, okay? This cross entropy is basically P of X given Y log R of X given Y. So R, remember, is our approximation function, okay? And we want to minimize this cross entropy so that effectively R of X is as close to P of X as possible. And in the process of minimizing this, I need to wave a wand, the infamous it can be shown wand, to say that this R of X, right, can become this thing here. Okay, so this thing here comes from a bit of complication. I don't want to talk about it too much, but this inequality sign comes from the fact that it's a bound on this thing called the evidence, and also it's because the KL divergence goes from zero. Is zero or greater than, and so it has this bound here. Okay, this is not a great explanation, but to go through all the maths basically requires much more time. The key is that now that we have this inequality, we can take this inequality and put it back into the cross entropy. Okay, and we can rewrite the cross entropy, the integral, into a sum. Okay, and expand these terms here, rearrange these terms. Okay. So that we have this term and this term become the red and the green term, and then this term is the blue term here. So this term here is actually the KL divergence between the green and the red, okay, which is this red term here. And this term here is actually the reconstruction loss at the output here. Okay. So in the process of we can calculate these things. And so in the process of calculating these things and minimizing the cross entropy, we basically are making this and the red and the blue much more like the posterior probability that we want to mimic. Okay. I have some slides with lots of maths if you want to have a look at it. Let's just go with that. And the key here is that when we test, we are going through our data. So to get a posterior sample, our data Y now passes through just the red and the blue box. Okay. And we can see that the red is R of Z of Y, and the blue is R of X given Z of Y. And if the product of these two are marginalized over Z is actually R of X and Y, okay? So the product, by going through these two, this encoder and this decoder, generating lots and lots of samples, we have basically obtained our approximation function here, okay? And so our X is basically something that is drawn from this particular distribution, and Z is the latent space, except here Z is a latent space for this particular R here, okay? So in a very sort of quick fire way, I hopefully tried to show you how this thing works. And this is about the losses, but what I want to say is that we need a GPU to run this, and we still need to do lots of training, and we need to train, and this is stops at that many epochs, but we could train for days, a couple of days. But this is an upfront cost, because once we train for days, we can generate posterior samples in less than a second, okay? So and not just for one signal, but for many, many different detections, of many, many different signals, we can do it in sub-seconds. Okay, and so here's an example. We run this and compare it to conventional samplers. Maybe you can't see this very well, but here's this. Basically, red is the output from vitamin, and blue and green are the outputs posteriors, and they all overlap each other very well. And if you squint, you might hopefully see that the marginal probabilities are all also lying on top of each other. Okay, so this thing can reproduce the posteriors, the required posterior probabilities, and even in multiple dimensions, this is a rather complicated case, but you can see that the red overlaps with the blue and the green. They're not perfect, but it also should be noted that some of these samplers, existing samplers, actually don't always entirely agree with each other as well. And here's sort of the key. The CVAE, the runtime to produce a sample is 10 to the less than a second, okay? So this vitamin can produce 104 posterior samples in of the order of 1 second. And these other samplers, which are the conventional samplers, can take tens of thousands of seconds. So this is where we gain a lot. We suggest to highlight that training still takes order of the factor of days, but it only needs to be done once with this asterisk being a caveat, and you can ask me about the caveats later, but because I'm running out of time. So yes, this is nice. I have to say that this work is still being updated because of referee comments from the paper. That's why the paper is still only in archive. And so this is now representative, but not exactly correct. We need to update this table, but that's what's in the public domain right now. To be fair, we need to highlight that these things called normalizing flows exist, and if you are interested in them, you should read this paper by Green, Stephen Green and Jonathan Gehr, and others. And basically, they work also by doing iterative transformations of a Gaussian blob And you can transform a Gaussian blob with iterative transformations into any shape that you want, including the posterior distributions. Okay, and so this is another nice way of doing rapid machine learning. And there are some. This is a very nice paper if you're interested about this as well. And also just to highlight that this normalizing flow method can be used to also speed up existing samplers, nested sampling. And this paper is also in the archive. And I'm also just trumpeting our own work at Glasgow here. Okay, but okay. In the last, I don't have very much time. Maybe I should just skip this and we can just talk about this later if you want to talk about generative adversarial networks, because they are fun and you can generate fake faces. These faces are all fake, by the way, they're not real people. And we use them to generate a series of crazy burst signals, okay? And the paper is here if you want to read about it. But I think in the interest of time and not sort of, I'll just go to the conclusions, leave them up there and wait for questions. Sorry for going so long.
Okay, thank you, Sean, for the very interesting talk, very nice. Any questions? Maybe, someone has a question? Or...
I can't see the participants, so you have to tell me if...
Right, so, let me probably, I can ask a question first. For these circular binaries, I mean, the parameter estimation is slow, but it's still, I guess, it can be done. But for eccentric binaries, this TO, we don't have a good frequency domain waveform. We have a time domain EOV, but it is extremely slow. So that's why, like, for the event like 1905, 21, people are trying to estimate the eccentricity, but they cannot get a very good argument for the things they're doing. So can you train on these eccentric waveforms and then do a fast parameter estimation for eccentric binaries?
Yes. So in principle, you can actually, yes. I would say yes. Okay. In principle, I've not done this myself, but you're right. We have thought about basically training it on precessing waveforms. There are people who have done this on various kinds of waveforms. There's a Korean group who has done this to generate spinning waveforms. I forget if eccentricity is involved. Actually, there are groups who have generated waveforms with eccentricity. So it is possible, yes, and this would be, yes, a rapid generator for conventional parameter estimation to get to bypass the bottleneck that is the waveform generation part. Yes.
Any additional questions?
Yeah, a question I have, and first, thank you for a very nice talk. But the question I have is, so all of this relies on training, and you have to declare the training to be complete before you can rely, you know, because before you can trust your results. So, you know, if I were to train for the digits problem using only 0, 1, 2, 3 up to 8, mm-hmm. and that was to, you know, train on this and then throw in a 9, then I would never, you know, classify the 9 appropriately. So the question is, so when do you decide when training is complete? And you know, you really have to make sure that you cover all the possible, you know, surprises that you might get in signals before, you know, before you can go live, so to speak. So I guess that's my question. So when do you declare training to be complete in those strategies?
Right. So firstly, I would say that the conventional parameter estimation also suffers from this problem, because Bayesian inference, you know, it's comparing the model. And if your model is a non-spinning waveform model applied to a spinning detection, it will not tell you that it's spinning, right?
That's true. Yeah.
So here in machine learning, it's the same situation. It is based on that training. Within that context, I would say that you look at the loss function, and the loss function will eventually tell you that you've explored enough of that parameter space. To answer your question beyond that, is to say that there are machine learning techniques that are sort of anomaly detectors, which are actually based on autoencoders, where if you've based it, trained 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and you give it a 9, then it tells you, aha, there's something there we don't expect. I'm not sure what to do with it, but you should have a look at this data. So it doesn't tell you that the answer is 9 because it still doesn't know what 9 doesn't exist. It still doesn't know that 9 exists, but at least it can tell you that it's not anything that is seen before. So that doesn't quite answer your question, but it's related, I guess.
It does. I think it's interesting. Thank you.
Any more questions?
Yeah, maybe another quick question that's related to what Eric asked. Siyoung, how does the vitamin approach work with a non-stationary PSD? Like, even if it's stationary over the duration of the signal, you know, tomorrow the PSD might be very different.
Right. So that's a very good point. And this is where the asterisks, remember the asterisks I said? So I think, and this is my opinion, although Chris has a slightly different opinion, it's more optimistic. I think you actually have to train, possibly train Vitamin on a regular basis to update the information of the PSD, because we know that the detector noise is not stationary. So every few days we maybe need to retrain the whole thing. Now, there is the Monash group. If people want to talk about the maths, they can. But the Monash group have this thing about rejection sampling. And Chris seems to think, he's explained it to me once, but I haven't quite come to grasp with it yet. But he seems to think that with rejection sampling, he can update the posteriors for different PSDs without having to do the whole entire retraining process. So there are ways around this, but I think regular training is probably the safest, but that's just me.
So
does
is
that
the
answer
idea
your questions? Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just, so the it, tell me if, I mean, we can take this offline, even more offline, but the rejection sampling is basically you use a single trained model to get something that is going to be up, close enough to the true posterior, and it's fast, and then you can do a refinement on top of that with, you know, maybe 100,000 samples or something instead of the huge cost of rerunning an MCMC.
Actually, now that you mention it, I think that's the idea that he has. So just to retrain it for the variation in the PSDs, because, you know, it's cheap for the Vitamin to create posterior samples, so we can just create lots of them and then use the rejection sampling to refine the posterior samples by throwing away some of them. I think that's the idea that Chris has, yes.
All right, that's very cool, thanks.
Any additional questions for Sean? Well, if not, let's thank Sean again for the very nice talk.
Thank you everyone for the